Blog Talk Radio.
Sonic Companion. I'm your host, Dale Graham. It's a pleasure to have you here. The 320th day of the year. Amazing, isn't it? 45 days left. That's to convert that into time with to enjoy the season, 38 days and 16 hours left until Christmas. It's here in this part of the world, it's snowing today. And sun is trying to poke through the clouds, but it's going to have its job cut out for it. I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the things that you notice about the craft, and I hope that I'm talking to the converted here. You know, Did you notice that as the craft has been, efforts were put in place to standardize to make consistent the practice of Freemasonry. We still have strong and distinct variations around the world. So that notion of doing things with some degree of uniformity really has been quite firm when one is a student of the essential nature, the landmarks of the order. We preserve the landmarks, and the rest is really variations that have to do with the culture and the landscape of the area in the world where Freemasonry is being practiced. And the thing that I noticed that we struggle to bring forward is the excitement of the time, the importance, the passion of Freemasonry. But our rituals are generally performed without that. They're really the words convey very powerful messages, but What we have done to ourselves for reasons that nobody will really begin to pinpoint is that we've stripped the opportunity to talk about meaning away from the ritual. The ritual is for what it is, and we walk away and digest it as if it were the hearty meal that it is. But we don't have that the value added, the collaboration, the discussion. And I think this is where our schooling may break down a little bit. Where do we learn to talk with each other but in school? Where do we learn to take turns? Where do we learn that it's not always best to talk because there's an opportunity unless you have something meaningful to say, truly meaningful to say? So we aren't all from the same educational philosophy. So when Freemasonry it gives us an opportunity to do that. But Freemasonry is very shy, very, very shy to admit that it really might not be sure how to go about doing that. I think that's something that is quite curious, don't you? Quite curious. curiosity is the theme of the show today, as you know. Well, my little epithet will make that clear. But it is a curious notion because as you piece together history, this wasn't a large landmark event from the start. Go back and think with me to the Big Bang of masonry. Was it this noble idea that just came upon the world and spread gleefully in all corners? Well, I tend to think it was the Big Bang was in the mind of a man spontaneously at different places in the face of the earth around the same period in the history of mankind and culture. So it was more than one starting spot. The Big Bang had that uniformity, that oneness, the singularity. It happened in many places at a similar time. And it wasn't at that molecular or particle level. This was at a cultural level. Now you think about it, when it was like thinking about Noah's Ark. I was thinking, trying to piece this together a little bit. And funny, the things that come to mind. Well, what if we called Noah's Ark Norman's Ark? And some of you will know where I'm getting that idea. You know, yes, of course. Does it matter who owned the Ark? Well, of course not. This is a composite. At the time when this was when the great flood, we were thinking in the diluvian, you know, antediluvian. We're going to be a little bit antediluvian here this morning. We're thinking about the big flood and talking about it when I was at the Sunday school, all of the animals being put on the ark, but these boys didn't know all the animals. They weren't travelers. You really think this it has to be a composite if we think about it. Probably hadn't seen a polar bear and hadn't seen an elephant or a camel or a giraffe or maybe a wildebeest or an oxen or a lynx or a lemur or, you know, gorillas. And think about it. Today, all that accumulated history matters. So when we're talking about all the animals, would it have been all the animals known to us? Just like the way you and I use our language. It's all the things that are qualified by what we know. That leaves things, raises the question of the things that we don't know. The metaphysical, the dark matter. Well, we're finding out that there's a lot of things in the dark matter, about dark matter, that are quite startling. This material that we can't determine seems to be greater than what we can determine. We know it's out there, this mass. The physicists have helped us to calculate that. But all of that aside, blah, 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 we're going to talk about metallic transmutation here. We're going to talk about that one a lot. Made me wonder that, you know, how alchemy is wrapped into Freemasonry. Yeah. So when some of us feel that it's sanitized, this is the pure essence of whatever religion that we practice, we're always challenged, because one of the nice things about Freemasonry and healthy things is that it allows us to set our beliefs and our faith on our shoulder, at a healthy, where it belongs, put it on our shoulder, on one shoulder, and then the other shoulder, it leaves this dialogue of challenge and question. Uniformity, universality, more than one faith The Masonic religion is that on which all men can agree. Is that yours? Hell no. So we have some safety. We can pull the covers over us at night and feel safe. These are things that we can count on, that the discussion goes on, that there are bits and pieces where we agree, and there are other elements that where we do not. Probably, if we were as intelligent as we claim, we would rely heavily on the scholars to lead us in this discussion. Lead the discussion, maybe not you and me, because we're too foolish to be led. and we've decided that all of a sudden we're masters of our own domain, yeah? We're independent, we need each other. That's for sure. That's another certainty we can count on. And we'll be there for each other in one way, shape, or form. But the idea of bringing the passion into the meaning of Freemasonry, I think, is really quite interesting because it never left. What left was the discussion. We've allowed this one to accumulate dust. This is like going into our grandmother's den and seeing the old piano, still well carefully oiled, but not played anymore. Yeah. Do you remember when your grandmother would always encourage you to sit down and play the piano? And do you remember the smells in the room? It was heavenly. And the stag's head high up on the wall and the stuffed ptarmigan on the mantle over the fireplace and the stuffed squirrel and some birds that were shot on the property and preserved in the old style. Do you remember the paintings of men with long beards and their wives, the very dour looking women sitting next to them with their hair tied down tightly, buttoned up and unsmiling because the shot took so long to get? Wasn't it these weren't happy people? It was the type of photography. It was very, very hard to get those shots because it took exposure to the... Well, go and read about that. That one's kind of fun. But bring it all forward. You remember how we felt apart. We were experiencing something from before. Well, Freemasonry had never really left. We just collected it. We've just let things get a little dusty. Our housekeeping hasn't been as great as it might be, but everything underneath is still in pristine condition because people cared about those things of importance. You only sat in the den when there were people of importance. So it wasn't the furniture wasn't worn out. It was beautiful and old and hand-carved and a wonderful environment where the books were mysterious and you saw a copy of the Bible that was well-thumbed and a copy of Robbie Burns that was well-thumbed. And we all had that experience because you were all with me when we were boys. Remember, curiosity killed the cat, didn't it? So I titled this today, Dark Matters. Dark matters. When we are children, the world is a literal place. Things are as they appear. The human brain, however, continues to develop. We have language before we have speech. You ever see people talking to a child as if you start off making sounds? The brain of that baby is still developing after it's born, after he or she is born. But very quickly, the children pick up language and they'll follow language. So if you speak to them as if they have language, they respond as if they have language. Interesting. But some people can tend to what's called infantilize babies into when they're able to walk, when they're able to go to school, and continue to fertilize the young people well into their 20s. When our great-grandfathers were walking around, they were taking on the responsibilities of what we know as full-grown men today. When they were 15 and 16, they were planning to set themselves up independently, build a house, continue the work that was familiar to their family, perhaps, find a partner, raise a family, defend their country. Today, we're scandalized. Our children the time and development of our children is squandered, not by them, but by us. We have lowered the expectations. Oh, and we can validate this, but we lowered them, I think, arguably, a little too far. And we didn't know that at the time. We had to go too far and take a look at the results and then figure out that we've got a problem and conclude that we have a problem and then find a solution. Well, the solution is probably going to be old school. Not that we can brag about that. I was right. I was there. I'm old. That makes us look foolish and detaches us from what's going on with these young men and women today. We don't want to do that, do we? Is that you reach this age of maturity and that's all you've got to put yourself to loud your lifespan over somebody else that's young? Really? You should be embarrassed. Babies have a sense of morality. You know that? Yeah. A sense of right and wrong. Yes, they show us this. We know these things because we started to watch. The more carefully you watch anything, the more you learn. You know, aude vide tace. Quiet. Shh. Shut up. Listen. You learn things when you're not talking all the time. Some infants show a capacity to share and care for others. Some, on the other hand, show competition. Infants. Today we know the brain continues to shed and produce cells all the time. Continues. If it is damaged, we know it can rewire. Call that brain plasticity. We don't quite understand what triggers that process or the processes of how that works, but we know it happens. We know concussion hurts the brain. We're watching what's happening with our children in sports fields. Man, we're beginning to understand. The damage to the brain is cumulative. Well, we've also known what affects the fetus. You know, mom drinking. That really sent our world for a bit of a tizzy. We have children whose development is eroded by the effects of alcohol in utero. We don't quite know how much. We don't know if it's one drink. Probably not. Common sense might suggest not. But if you're doing drugs and moms that do drugs, and some children do pop through and very, very bright, don't they? So are we thinking, well, we're going to optimize the development of every child? Think about what we're doing here. We've also optimized the development of every apple in the tree. It has to be that nice 3-inch diameter, or we don't want it. Remember, red and three uniform. Fruit doesn't grow uniform. That's nature. Oh, but what do we call it now? We even have names for these, organic. So our engineer, we're pretty clever engineers, aren't we? We know how to do things better. Uniformity is better. Well, we cut down all the trees in the forest, and then we plant only the kind that grows the fastest and produces the kind of material that we can use in our factories. So we're trying to commodify nature around us. We're pretty good at it, aren't we? You have to admit, the Amazon, Canada was a place where that was just, you know, can you imagine 100-foot birch? Can you imagine stands of it? Oak and maple. It's all been mined, all been taken. Can you imagine in Britain, though, they were doing this back in the 13th and 14th century, 15th century. There was a time when there wasn't any trees left. The entire face of Britain has been replanted. Yeah, they learned the hard way. Long, long history. Did we learn from those mistakes? Well, our leaders are still using and abusing this place as if it's our human toilet, our Great Lakes, our oceans. So no reason to be bragging that we know better, and kids should do it our way. Good Lord, they should learn from our mistakes, should run from us if they see us starting to engineer and control their lives. But the morality, that wasn't anything to do with us. The rules of the game, that wasn't anything to do with us. That was right-minded men and women. We see pictures of the brain with dementia, but we don't really know why it has plaques and tangles, just that it does. The brain coordinates all the functions of a human being. What of the mind? Is it artistic? Is it smart? Does it have insight? How about memory? What of personality? Sanguine? Phlegmatic? Melancholic? Choleric, perhaps? What limits your progress? Are you sure you know your own potential? Likely not. Huh, we call it a cult or esoteric. But what we mean is knowledge of the hidden. The Sonic Companion walks into the laboratory, curious about truths that are hidden in there. This place calls on us to use our minds in a way that is beyond the reason we use every day. It is believing the unbelievable. We once mocked those who believed he could turn lead into gold. Today, particle accelerators make nuclear transmutation possible. Using atomic weights, tin has atomic weight of 50. Copper has an atomic weight of 29. You add those together and it's 79, isn't it? You know what has the atomic weight of 79? Well, of course I do, Dale. I was just thinking about that this morning when I got up eating my Cheerios. Atomic weight of 79 is gold. Oh my. You do the math. The only people still laughing may never understand. But we're used to that. We're Masons. Yeah. Curiosity killed the cat. Be with me today. Be with me today. It's coming up to a I don't know, I have this need to appreciate things from the past, respect them, but not think that they dominate the landscape. I really, it creeps me out when I see everything being a commemorative, the people that have died. It does. I don't mean disrespect, and anybody would say I'm not respectful. I should suck it up, back off, stand down, whatever. I don't respect people the same way you do. But it creeps me out. The world I live in is a place where we want to celebrate growth. A young woman a few months ago asked the question, why do we commemorate bad things? And we were talking about monuments for, you know, war monuments. When she made the point, war is not good. And she pointed out, why do we not commemorate greatness? And I would think, well, why not as well? If I can't quite figure out why we commemorate bad things, could we at least balance it? Why is that? So I put that to you. Why do we have such a struggle celebrating greatness with monuments? Oh, well, you could say, oh, Dale, do you remember the sculpture in Vienna or the paintings? Have you forgotten that? You know what I mean? We don't see plaques going up commemorating that there was something beautiful that was created. We don't talk about that. That's not on the news. That's not news. What we like to talk about is the car accident. And in person, we can say it's terrible. But we're quite voyeuristic. We have to look. We slow down to look to see. It says something about us. I'm not here to tell you what that says. You do the work yourself. Figure that out. There was a storm on the 10th of November in 1975, you know. 29 sailors went down with the ship. The ship happened to be the largest in North America's Great Lakes. And she remains the largest to have sunk. This ship, the Edmund Fitzgerald, sank in Lake Superior storm. For 17 years, it carried taconite iron ore from the mines of Duluth, Minnesota, to the ironworks in Detroit and Toledo. She set seasonal haul records 6 times, often breaking her own previous record. Captain Peter Pulcher was known for piping music day or night over the ship's intercom system while passing through the Sinclair and Detroit rivers, entertaining spectators at the Sioux Locks with a running commentary about the ship, her size, record-breaking performance, and DJ captain endeared the Fitzgerald to boat watchers. She's carrying a cargo of iron ore pellets with Captain Ernest McSorley in command. She left on her final voyage from Superior, Wisconsin, near Duluth, on the afternoon of the 9th of November, 1975, and she was headed for Detroit. And she joined a second freighter, the SS Arthur M. Anderson. By the next day, the two ships were caught in the midst of a severe winter storm on Lake Superior. It had near hurricane force winds, waves of up to 35 feet, 11 meters. Just after 7:10, the Fitzgerald suddenly sank in Canadian waters. She went down in 160 meters. She was 17 miles from the entrance to Whitefish Bay. And that's near the Twin Cities between Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan and Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario. The Fitzgerald could have covered that in 2 hours at her top speed. But although the Fitzgerald had reported being in difficulty earlier, no distress signals were sent before she sank. McSorley's last message to the Anderson, "We're holding our own." Her crew, 29, perished, and no bodies were recovered. But there were many theories and stories and expeditions to examine the cause of the sinking. Fitzgerald might have fallen victim to the high waves of the storm, or it had structural failure. You know, could have broken its back, been swamped by water entering through the cargo hatches, and just became topsided and shoaled in the shallow part of Lake Superior. It's one of the best known, ignominiously, best known disasters in the history of Great Lakes shipping. See, it is the cruelest month in the water, on the water, isn't it? You know, after the investigators got to it, led to changes in the Great Lakes shipping regulations and practices that include mandatory survival suits and depth finders and positioning systems, increased freeboard, and more inspection of vessels. Think because of the weather conditions. So, there you have it, eh? First Laker built to the maximum St. Lawrence Seaway size, 730 feet long, 75 feet wide, with a 25-foot draft. Man. Man. Sad time. Just a taste. Here, of course, you have to listen to a wee bit of this.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down to the big lake they call Mitchigumi. The lake, it is said, never gets up for dead when the skies of November turn gloomy. With a load of iron ore, 26,000 tons more than the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty. That good ship and true was a bone to be chewed when the gales of November came early. Ship was the pride of the American side, coming back from some mill in Wisconsin. As the big freighters go, it was bigger than most, with a crew and good captain well seasoned. Concluding some terms with a couple of steel firms when they left fully loaded for Cleveland. Then later that night, when the ship fell in, could it be the north wind they'd been feeling?
Sad, eh? That's Canada. Things like that, well remembered. That is Canada. What an interesting, interesting country we live in. But I'm sure that that type of lament speaks loudly to sailors and their families and their relatives. Doesn't matter. Well, we were having a great time with Christopher Wren so we'll leave a little blurb about that. Did it raise any conclusions for you? Maybe a few. To continue on about Wren, we have to refer to the work, the Constitutions of Reverend James Anderson. I'm not so foolish to think that he wrote it alone. Interesting, though, that he is credited for that. And it doesn't even mean that he took credit, because sometimes we have the politics of the writing, where it could be something as superficial as somebody being slighted by the other people in the room or that were participating. We see that. You've seen that. Or just not having enough space on a line. Who wrote it? Or a bad memory. Well, I can't remember all of those people that were involved, so I would just say it was over the years. Anderson is given credit for it, but I like to think of him as an editor. I think rightfully so. These aren't ideas that popped out of his mind. Just like you ask yourself, do we have any original thought? Or is it cumulative knowledge that Carl Jung talked about, helped define? But anyway, Reverend James Anderson wrote the first Constitution. He was an interesting character. He was born in 1679, educated in Aberdeen, and he became a Presbyterian minister in 1707 and soon moved to London to take over the Presbyterian Church in Swallow Lake in Westminster. He married a wealthy woman. Good for you there, buddy. But then lost heavily in the South Sea Company crash of 1720. You know about the South Sea bubble. Interesting piece of history. Most of Scotland was pulled into that. You know, easy money to be had. And they invested heavily in support. Did well. So today, when you hear about, you know, that lingeringly jovial mockery about a Scotsman being tight with his money, this might be the event that taught everybody. And of course, it's living history. Be careful. His decision to take up writing professionally may have been prompted by a need for cash, probably. He was an active Freemason and had been appointed Grand Warden by the time the first edition of his constitutions were published. Here we go, his. Anderson's constitutions are very important documents because they purported to be official. In fact, they were only semi-official. We didn't know that, did we? Anderson was associated with the Grand Lodge, and they were produced with its assent. But the profits were entirely Anderson's, and the book was privately printed, not underwritten by Grand Lodge. Let me go over that again there. The profits were entirely Anderson's, and the book was privately printed, not underwritten by Grand Lodge. They contained not just the regulations of Freemasonry in general, and the Grand Lodge in particular, but also a potted history of Freemasonry up to that time, together with assorted items such as the Entered Apprentice song, which have remained much loved and in use to the present day. We've peeled a few things. We've sanded off the surface a little bit, haven't we? We've left things. That's part of what's accumulated dust. The self-consciousness of a group of men. They've forgotten how to, that they have a voice and that they can sing. Start up a song in a lodge and you see grown men, grown Masons who've known each other for years being enormously self-conscious as schoolboys. If it wasn't so sad, it would be laughable. The first edition of Anderson's Constitution was published in 1723, and it did mention Wren, but only as an architect. Indeed, in his first edition, Anderson provided very little information on the history of the craft. What he did give was a short potted history of architecture. His account of the second edition in 1738 is altogether different. There are certain passages that were there in the first that just vanished. Of course, if you're printing your own book, you can probably print what you want. Between the first and the second editions, a number of noble men have been persuaded to become Freemasons and been made successive Grand Masters of the Grand Lodge. Anderson's revised constitution set out to demonstrate that this is not a new occurrence, which it almost certainly was, but one that had a long history. What he was doing was drawing on the notion of provenance that didn't exist. We see this in many areas of culture and history. In order to give credibility to a new initiative, the designers will claim a provenance. Oh, here, we had roots of this in the Egyptian pyramids. Okay. Those types of statements, you know, the things that are just absolutely, we'll take issue with metaphysics. Oh, there's nothing that isn't, you know, we'll be literal. But then we'll jump on board this train that makes these outlandish claims that historically couldn't happen. So easy on one hand to dismiss the unbelievable, and so ready and willing to accept something that is so transparently manipulative. Okay, admit it, we like to be manipulated. Make this nasty part simple. Oh, you'll take care of me? Oh, okay. And as long as my privacy is being abused for the sake of the security of all of us, have at it. All those battles and wars that were fought for my freedoms, have at that. Just hack away at it. You come up with a loose-assed explanation or a rationale, have at it. The purpose is so noble. Who am I to challenge that? It's the start of the totalitarian slide, isn't it? Wow. Have we forgotten so much of our history? Have we forgotten what history teaches us? Man, no wonder Freemasons have been persecuted and prosecuted over the years. Remember, he set out, Anderson's revised constitution set out to demonstrate that this is not a new occurrence, which it almost certainly was, but one that had a long history. The result was a new, completely revised history. Revised. Now, good Lord, a Masonic companion, we do what we can to point out the problem with revisionists. You take history and rewrite it to suit yourself. How about we go back to what was unvarnished? Oh, the truth. Really does push up against our shores a bit, doesn't it, here? So a completely new revised history that showed that everyone of interest from Adam to King William III had not only been a Mason, but also a Grand Master or figures of importance in the craft. Still buying it? Hence, Freemasonry could count on kings, noblemen, great architects amongst its supporters and leaders throughout the ages. But the section on Masonry in Wren's time begins like this. So this is great fun. Just great fun when we're describing something that was in the shadows here. This is about Wren. Charles II, Stuart, succeeded his father and was magnificently restored, age 30 years, on his own birth date, the 29th of May, 1660. He resolved to encourage the Augustan style by reviving the lodges and approved their choice of Henry Germain, Earl of St. Albans, as their Grand Master, who appointed Sir John Denham his deputy Grand Master, Sir Christopher Wren / Mr. John Webb Grand Wardens. According to a copy of the old constitutions, this Grand Master held a general assembly and feast on St. John's Day, the 27th December, 1663. The certainty with which these events are depicted makes them sound convincing. The names, too, all seem initially plausible. Henry Germain was ambassador to France and an incredibly important person. John Denham was surveyor of the king's works. John Webb was his deputy and a prominent architect who had been trained by and worked under the great architect Inigo Jones before the Civil War. The British Civil War, of course. Anderson goes on to tell how Thomas Savage, Earl of Rivers, became Grand Master in June 1666, appointing Wren as his deputy Grand Master, and John Webb and Grinling Gibbons as his wardens. He goes on to list prominent buildings of the period, including the laying of the foundation stone of St. Paul's in 1673, assisted by the Grand Wardens, Edward Strong, Sr. and Jr. All this sounds convincingly enough. However, on closer examination, it turns out that Anderson's account is riddled with factual errors. I don't know if I'd say it was errors. I'd say a deliberate effort to mislead, misguide, and embellish. For instance, Gibbons did not arrive in England until 1667, and then thus could not possibly have been made a Grand Warden in 1666. Moreover, he was only 18 in 1666. and not introduced to Wren by John Evelyn until 1671. How can he have acted with Wren as warden when Wren had not met him and he had not entered the country? The cases of Edward Strong Sr. and Jr. are equally absurd. They cannot have been grand wardens in 1673. Edward Strong Jr. was not born until 1676. And Edward Strong Sr. was only 21 in 1673. Even the date of the laying of the foundation stone is wrong. We know from contemporary documents that it was definitely laid in 1675. 2 years later than Anderson states. You get the picture. Anderson is not exactly reliable. Indeed, he seems to be making it all up, and nothing he says can be taken as historical evidence. Anderson's dubious account then goes on to state that after the death of Henry Bennet, Earl of Arlington, in 1685, Sir Christopher Wren was elected Grand Master and appointed Mr. Gabriel Kibber, Mr. Edward Strong, Grand Wardens. But he goes on to claim that Wren initiated King William III. None of this, absolutely none of this, corresponds to any known documentation. The next part of the story is particularly important. Anderson states, and all Masons lean forward on the edge of the chair for this one, and this is written in the old style of English, so bear with me. Yet still in the south, the lodges were more and more disused, were more diffused, sorry. F's and S's were the same in the day. Yet still in the south, the lodges were more and more diffused, partly by the neglect of the masters and wardens, and partly by not having a noble grand master at London, and the annual assembly was not duly attended. Grand Master Wren, who had designed St. Paul's, London, A.D. 1673, and as master of work had conducted it from the footstone, had the honor to finish that noble cathedral, the finest and largest temple in the Augustan style except St. Peter's at Rome, and celebrated the capstone when he erected the crafts at the top of the cupola in July 1708. After some few years after this, Sir Christopher Wren neglected the office of Grand Master. Yet the old lodge near St. Paul's and a few more continued their stated meetings until Queen Anne died. Again, the dates of the laying of the capstone at St. Paul's and the foundation are incorrect. But he goes on. St. George I entered London on 20th September 1714 after 1716. The few lodges in London, finding themselves neglected by Sir Christopher Wren, thought fit to cement under a Grand Master as the center of union and harmony. They forthwith revived the quarterly communication of the officers of lodges called the Grand Lodge, resolved to hold the annual assembly and feast, and then to choose a Grand Master from among themselves, till they should have the honor of a noble brother at their head. Thus, Anderson's unreliable account managed to invent a number of important myths about Wren's involvement in the craft. First, that Wren was a Mason. And second, that Wren had been Grand Warden from 1660 to 1666, Deputy Grand Master from 1666 to 1685, and the Grand Master from 1685 to 1695, and the Deputy Grand Master from 1695 to 1698. and the Grand Master from 1698 to 1716. That it was as a direct result of Wren's neglect that the original Grand Lodge declined and had to be reformed in 1717. According to Anderson, then, Wren was not only a Mason, but a vital, important one who had been the Grand Master of all Masons for over 20 years, and was personally responsible for the neglect of the old Grand Lodge, leading to the requirement for the formation of a new one. But despite the fact that in 1738, a few must still have remembered the truth of what had happened 20 years before, Anderson's account was not challenged in print at the time, and as a result, it was taken at face value throughout the 18th century. The reasons for this are not difficult to determine. The only people interested in the truth of Anderson's account were the Masons themselves. It was clearly in their interest to maintain the myth that there had been a long history of Grand Lodge, and that someone as important as Wren had been a Grand Master. This myth was no different from the ancient ceremonies and traditional histories that the Masons had been busy making up at the time to enlarge and enliven Masonic meetings. To pick that one up, this myth is no different from the ancient, quote, ancient ceremonies and traditional histories that the Masons had been busy making up at the time to enlarge and enliven Masonic meetings. Does that mean that they have been busy doing this, making this up, so that more people would join and there would be more lively discussion? They were all part of the same new mythical structure. So this wasn't historically valid. This is the myths. Hansel and Gretel. Fairy tales, eh? Fairy tales are for children, myths are for men. Gee, I wish I'd known. I can handle things, the value of myth and allegory. I can do that. I'm not ridiculous. But I also need to know when I'm presenting something that presented something as historically factual. That is myth. It makes me look the fool if I don't know better. It makes me look the fool in the eyes of somebody that knows better. What to do with this information? It is now accepted that there is absolutely no evidence for a Grand Lodge before 1717, and thus no Grand Master as we would understand it today. Nor was there a long history of aristocratic membership, although there may well have been a few aristocratic members before 1700. Despite this, wait, that paragraph tells us a remarkable amount of information. Masonry existed before 1717, as it was often claimed. Masonry is not Grand Lodge. Masonry is not fabricated history. It is something deeper and more authentic than both those statements. And it's important, I think, that we realize that. When we walk into Lodge, there are literalists around us. You know, Noah had two of every animal on the ark. By cracky. Two of every species known to the people that made up the story. Yeah, so we had birds and fish, I don't know, and mammals and snakes. Yeah. And by the way, maybe it was a pomegranate and not an apple. And maybe Eve and that notion that women are evil was fabricated too. Oh my. But get a grip here. Despite this, Anderson's mythological history was highly entertaining. Hear, hear. And was repeated in subsequent publications. Hear, hear. Harry Potter of his time, I'm with you. The more times it appeared in print, the more credence it gained. It was to remain the standard account until the end of the 18th century when William Preston revised it. Do you want to know? Remember, curiosity killed the cat. You're not going to walk around with your smug little references to Anderson anymore. You sure you want to hear it? This is a spoiler alert. There's a little bit of truth here coming out. Yeah. Get your favorite beverage and sit down and listen to this. Get your glass of, well, it's not summer, so you don't have your glass of Kool-Aid, but get something that's suitable. Maybe something warm, a toddy, a cider. If we were in Glencoe in the day, we would be sitting at breakfast, an open bottle of whiskey on the table for everybody in the family. Interesting how culture affects morality. Mm-hmm. William Preston was a colorful character, utterly devoted to masonry. We owe him a debt of gratitude, for it was he who left the sum of £300 for the lectures that bear his name to this day. He was also responsible for moving the ceremonies closer to the ones we have today. Preston was a man of opinion and energy, capable of giving and taking offense in equal measure. By trade, he was a publisher. He managed the printing operations of Strand, the king's printer, for it was his Freemasonry he is remembered. He was, at one point, the assistant grand secretary of Grand Lodge, and he made money on the side from writing on Masonic matters. His illustrations of Masonry was a bestseller, going to 9 editions. The first edition of Illustrations of Masonry, which came out in 1772, contains no history whatsoever. The second edition, which came out in 1775, was a radical reworking to the extent it almost completely a new book. In it, he tackled history for the first time, but Wren is barely mentioned, and where he is, the text slavishly follows Anderson's mythological history. 2 more editions followed the same form, but in 1792, Preston reworked his section on Wren, expanding it with architectural description from a biography of Wren entitled Parentalia, and more detail on Wren's Masonic activity, including a reference to the lodge. His new account is as follows. At the Revolution, the society was so much reduced to the south of England that there are no more than 7 regular lodges met in London and its suburbs, of which 2 only were worthy of notice. The old lodge of St. Paul's, over which Sir Christopher had presided during the building of the structure, and a lodge at St. Thomas's Hospital, Southwark, over which Sir Robert Clayton, then Lord Mayor of London, presided during the rebuilding of that hospital. Thomas Savage, the Earl of Rivers, having succeeded the Earl of St. Albans in the office of Grand Master in June 1666, Sir Christopher Wren was appointed deputy under his lordship, and distinguished himself more than any of his predecessors in office in promoting the prosperity of the few lodges which occasionally met at the time. Particularly the old lodge of St. Paul's, now the Lodge of Antiquity, which he patronized upwards of 18 years. The honors with which this celebrated character afterwards received in the society are evident proofs of the attachment the fraternity bore to him. Aha! Little aside. It appears from the records of the Lodge of Antiquity that Mr. Wren at this time attended the meetings regularly, and that during his presidency he presented to the lodge 3 mahogany candlesticks, at that time truly valuable, which are still preserved and highly prized as a memento. I will return to the Lodge of Antiquity and its candlesticks later. It is worth noting here that the date of Wren joining the Old Lodge of St. Paul's is not mentioned. But if Preston is right, and he was a member for 18 years, leaving in 1708 or 10, then he would have joined around somewhere around 1690 to 1692, which, as we see, matches other accounts. He left in 1708. 19th century challenging this myth. By the beginning of the 19th century, thanks to Anderson and Preston, there was a general acceptance that Wren was not only a member of the craft, but had been the head of it. The question we must now ask is when and how, why did this change? How did we get to the stage of doubting Wren as a member at all? You have to come back. You have to come back. You guys are going to find out. You have to come back. Come back and join me. Come on. Yeah, really. Come back next week. This is Masonic Companion. We're working way too hard here for you. So what have we learned? What have you heard? What did it mean? But most important, what did it say to you? I try to give a bit of a running narrative about what it says to me. Not to impose that on you. Certainly not. Certainly not. Sometimes I think that I take seriously that notion that I am my brother's keeper. It's probably a bit related to the work that I've done over my entire career. I help people that have lost track of their mind, that are having problems with function. It strips away the stories that people want the world to know about themselves. Strips it down to the way people are. So you find that from time to time I have a little patience for people that are transparent and full of beans. It's different. We'll talk about this. Sideways, I guess. But when I'm giving a narrative, it's like, always be thinking about the meaning. I hope. If it doesn't mean anything to you, then I failed. It's not you. I haven't done something right. That's the way I think. Of course, I know better than that. But I think that I should have done something more entertaining that gripped you. It had more meaning. Well, the only way that connection works is if I follow up on the things that I find are authentically Masonic and truthful and useful. But you have to, it's for you to sort out meaning and what it says to you, whether it affects you or not. Here we learn that Anderson's Constitution. How often have I heard that referred to as if it is gospel? Even then I laugh, because even the gospel is being rewritten as history is bringing forward new facts to validate. Yeah, and I want to cling. Don't you just want to cling to everything that's familiar? Hell no. You keep your 1955 Oldsmobile. At my age, I couldn't pull that. You remember no power steering trying to heave that behemoth around a corner? What was it? 3 or 4 tons of Detroit steel? If you ran into anything, everybody in the front lost their teeth on the steel dash. Nothing to laugh about, I realize. It's an amazing world we live in. It is absolutely amazing. Freemasonry is the opportunity. So, truly the opportunity. And you so fall in love with things from the past. If it spikes your interest, by all means, by all means. How about a little bit of music? We've been together for our hour is up. I try to keep it around an hour or so. I hope you've liked the show tonight. I hope you'll come back and join me. We're going to try and get into rounding this information about William Preston or Wren and Anderson off. And no, I haven't forgot at all that notion of tucking into the metaphysics, to the hidden, the occult, the esoteric nature of masonry. But remember, curiosity killed the cat. We're going to talk about the ancient mysteries and secret societies and the things that influence modern Masonic symbolism. We have to do this. We have to. It's like this. Here's a little taste. When confronted with a problem involving the use of reasoning faculties, individuals of strong intellect keep their poise and seek to reach a solution by obtaining facts bearing upon the question. Those of immature mentality, on the other hand, when similarly confronted, are overwhelmed. While the former may be qualified to solve the riddle of their own destiny, the latter must be led like a flock of sheep and taught in simple language. They depend almost entirely upon the ministrations of the shepherd. The Apostle Paul said that these little ones must be fed with milk, but that meat is the food of strong men. Thoughtlessness is almost synonymous with childishness, when thoughtfulness is symbolic of maturity. Thanks for joining me today. I look forward to sitting in lodge with you again real soon.
Oh,